So my pleasure and privilege is to introduce the first speaker of this session this morning, who is Cyril Ziepfeld. Cyril is a professor at University of East Anglia, Norwich, UK. He's the head of the Sainsbury Institute, which is, as he says, and I think he's right, the biggest institute in plant research in the world. So this is a good introduction in a way. Cyril is very special because he's been really one of the pioneers in the field of innate immunity of plants. And especially he's been producing some very interesting and novel research results in the field of how microbes are sensed, perceived by plants, especially how they are perceived through receptor kinases that sense what's called bacterial PAMPs. Motifs like flagellin, for instance, which is one of the motif he studies, and how they transmit signals inside the cell of the plant so that they respond to these microbes and set up this so-called innate immune response. This is just a sort of sample of what Cyril is doing, and I'm calling him now. I'm sure you will enjoy what he's going to tell us.
Okay, can you hear me? Yes. Good morning. First of all, I really would like to thank the organizer for inviting me. It's a great honor to be invited to this journée and also to be the first speaker of this morning's sessions. And I would like to thank Philippe as well for the kind introduction. So before I start, the way I structure my talk today, because I thought you're not necessarily used to listen to someone working on plants, is to give a rather long introduction, and rather to bombard you with data, I will give you an introduction, followed by the introduction, sorry, I will give you a summary of our recent work on immune signaling. And at the end of my presentation, I will actually show you some examples of how in recent years we have been using the knowledge of, based on our fundamental research program about how to try to engineer crops to become more resistant to disease in the field. But before I start, because plant biology is a rare discipline in biology in general, I thought it's important to remind people why plants are important. And this may sound obvious, but it's not always obvious to politicians. And the amount of funding that goes to plant biology is really minute in comparison to the amount of funding going to biomedicine, for example. But without plants, we would not be here. They produce the oxygen that we breathe. They produce the foods and drinks that we consume every day. They produce the materials which this amphitheater is made of. They produce directly or indirectly the fuel that we use for our cars and our buses. And obviously, they also produce high-end products, such as drugs, for example, or cosmetics. But beyond that, also people often see plants as something which is very somehow static, which is beautiful to look at, maybe boring. They don't necessarily assume that they are sophisticated organism. And I work on immunity. I'm a plant immunologist. Some people might find this term striking, and I try to explain to you why this is not different than studying immunity in Drosophila or nematodes, for example. But first, I want to remind you a few key differences if you are used to listen to presentation on immunity in mammals. But yet, like all non-mammalian organisms, plants only rely on innate immunity for their defense. They don't have any specialized immune cells, circulatory immune cell. Any cell is capable, in principle, to recognize the presence of microbe or danger. But yet, upon perception at the cell autonomous perception system, immune responses can be both local, but also can act systemically. This means that if one part of the plant would sense the presence of a danger, another part would be prepared to respond more strongly and more rapidly to a second threat posed to the plant. And also there are some reports in the literature that there may be transgenerational memory of stress, although this is rather controversial. So I will try not to bombard you with terms or acronyms, which may be plant-specific. This is one of the rare acronyms, the list of acronyms I will use in my presentation, and these are exactly the same terms which I use in innate immunity in animals. It now became clear that plants use two types of receptor to perceive microbes. A first class is present here at the plasma membrane, and the second class is present within the cell. And if there is one thing you need to remember of this presentation, I would be already happy if this is the case, that plants have two types of receptors at the surface and within the cell. The function of this immune receptor is exactly the same, is to perceive non-self, is to perceive something which is a potential danger to the plant. These immune receptors at the surface are called pattern recognition receptor, and they recognize this conserved molecule, which are called PAMs, pathogen-associated molecular patterns. To make things more confusing, a lot of plant biologists these days like to refer to them as MAMs, for microbe-associated molecular patterns, because they are not specific to pathogen. So this is a true definition, but the historical definition is PAMs, so I will keep to that. And this will activate the first layer of immune responses in plant, which is called PTI, for PRR trigger immunity or PAM trigger immunity. As a response of this very efficient first layer of immune detection, successful pathogens have either to evade this recognition or to actively suppress immune responses triggered by this recognition. Many pathogens, such as bacteria, for example, will directly inject within the plant cell effectors. And one of the functions of this effector is to directly suppress either the receptors. Some of them will, for example, lead to the degradation of this receptor, or to actively suppress downstream signaling triggered by the activation of this receptor. But yet, by doing so, by suppressing this first layer of immune responses, the pathogen have then the unlikely possibility, if you want, or unfortunate possibility, to activate a second layer of immune detection. And this is the one mediated by this intracellular immune receptor. Many of them are similar to NOD proteins, for example, in human, an atypical NLR immune receptor. And this NLR would recognize either directly these effectors, but this seems to be the exception in plant. And most of this detection is actually indirect, where this NLR will actually indirectly perceive the modification of the host physiology triggered by this effector. And this will lead to the second layer of immune responses in plant, which is called effector trigger immunity. But remember, all of these responses are of an innate nature. So in my lab, we concentrate on studying this first layer of immunity, which is mediated by these PRRs. Since decades, we actually know that plants have the ability to recognize a number of different microbial molecules. Many of them are conserved, and this is just a list, which is not exhaustive, of all the different types of molecules that can activate innate immune responses in plant. And you can see that some of them are sugars, some of them are lipids, and some of them are protein or small peptides. And we now know elicitors or PAMs from oomycete, which is a major class of plant pathogen, fungi, bacteria. More recently, there is also evidence, finally, that viral PAMs, such as the classical PAMs, which are also recognized by our own innate immune system, can also be recognized by surface localized receptor in plants. And what is important also to realize is that molecules from the plant itself can be recognized by the plant. And these are molecules generally not available for recognition, but will become available for recognition upon infection. They may be caused by the degradation of the plant cell wall, for example, or they may actively be secreted in response of wounding or pathogen infection. And some of them are, for example, the oligogalacturonide, which is one of the major constituents of the plant cell wall. More recently, there was evidence that pests, so animals, can also be recognized by the plant innate immune system by such receptors. This is the case for insects, for nematodes. And also a few weeks ago, I was part of a study that also revealed that plant can perceive another plant, in this case a parasitic plant, as a danger and mount an immune response to defend itself against this parasitic plant. The other thing which is important to know is while I'm listing here examples of molecules that can be recognized by the plant immune system, not all of these molecules are recognized by all plant species. There is a certain degree of recognition specificity. And this is something that we are using to our advantage, and I will illustrate this at the end of my presentation, for biotechnological purposes. But we can see that a lot of us plant scientists are using Arabidopsis thaliana, which is this weed here, as a model system. And actually many of these molecules are recognized by Arabidopsis thaliana, which is the one that I've highlighted here in green. And so this makes it a very useful model system to study innate immunity in plant. So this is a very active field of research. And we start to know more about the way, the molecular basis of immune perception in plant. And I took this schematic from a review I wrote in 2012. And this was back then summarizing the few examples of PRRs that we knew from plant. I don't want to go into the detail of this figure. The only thing I want to illustrate using this figure is that now we know that plant PRR belong to two biochemical classes of proteins. They can either be receptor kinases. This is, for example, our receptor kinase would look. It would have an ectodomain, which would be involved in ligand binding, a single pass transmembrane domain, and an intracellular kinase domain. The other class of plant PRR would rather look like this, which is an ectodomain, a transmembrane domain, but the absence of any recognizable intracellular signaling domain. And we call this protein receptor-like proteins. But based on this knowledge, on this few examples, we already, the community, could already show that PAM perception contribute to basal as well as non-NOS resistances. This is a term which I use in plant biology. Basal resistance is basically the immunity which is mounted in the case of a compatible interaction. Well, disease will actually occur, but yet there is a certain level of immunity which restricts the strength of the disease progression. Non-NOS resistance is this beautiful phenomenon in plant whereby when a pathogen is adapted to infect a plant, for example, tomato, often it will not be able to infect another plant belonging to the same family. A tomato pathogen, for example, very rarely will be able to infect a potato. And this is what we call non-NOS resistance. And there is a lot of hope that if we were to understand the molecular basis of non-NOS resistance, we could engineer crops which are more resistant to disease because this is a durable type of resistance. We know as well that PAM confer what is called broad spectrum disease resistance. This means if the plant perceives a conserved molecules from bacteria, let's say flagellin, it will be able to mount resistance against many different bacteria. In addition, what we know is that if we treat a plant, let's say with a bacterial PAM, such as flagellin, the plant will be protected against fungal or viral infection. The type of immune responses which is mounted is not tailored against a specific pathogen. But the problem, and this was particularly true in 2012, is that we only know a few plant PRRs. So as I mentioned, this is a very active field of research. And now, 2 years later, after 2012, now I'm taking a schematic from a review I wrote in 2014. This number has almost doubled. We can still say that plant PRRs are either receptor kinases or receptor-like protein, but we have more examples of the type of molecules which are recognized. And also, these PRRs are coming for directly from crops such as wheat or rice or tomato here that will make translational studies more useful or easier in the future. So based on this knowledge, we are now in 2016, and actually this number has at least doubled since in the last 2 years, and we are currently preparing a new review that will illustrate this. But what is important to realize is that maybe unlike in human, plant genome actually encoding hundreds of potential PRRs. I'm not saying that all plant receptor kinases or receptor-like protein are involved in immune recognition. Many of them are actually playing a role in growth and development, but the large proportion of this protein may be actually involved in immune responses. And now that we have more and more examples of plant PRRs which are being characterized, we can actually find some pattern, biochemical patterns within the sequence of this protein that help us to predict which one may actually involve in immune perception. And again, this is really helping the field to identify the repertoire in given plant species of their immune receptors. What I would like to do now in the next few minutes is actually just to make brief comparison between what is known for innate immunity in plant and what is known for innate immunity in animal. The first thing I want to illustrate here is if you consider a receptor kinase, and if you consider one that has leucine which repeats in its ectodomain, which is a major class of plant PRRs, LRR type receptor kinases, they are not directly comparable to TOL or TOL-like receptor, which are famous innate immune receptor in insects and mammals. But what you could realize is that here in a plant receptor kinase, this protein is directly fused to a kinase domain which is involved in signaling transduction downstream of the perception. And actually, phylogenetically, this kinase is related to Pili and Arax, which are the major kinases involved downstream of toll-like receptor and toll in animal. But yet, toll-like receptor and toll are not directly fused to a kinase. They are fused to a T-domain. And this T-domain, which is a protein-protein interaction motif, would actually interact with other adapters having T-domain, ultimately leading, indeed, to the recruitment and activation of these kinases, which I mentioned, Arax and Pili. And this type of organization, which is a sort of macromolecular receptor complex in animal, is often referred to as a lysosome. And so maybe in a provocative way, what I would like to propose here is that at least in the case of leucinowitz repeat receptor kinases in plant, they fuse a lysosome into one single protein, directly coupling ligand perception here within the domain to signaling propagation using this kinase here. The other difference is that plants and animals have actually evolved to recognize similar structures, similar molecules to activate the immune system. This is a case, for example, here for flagellin, which has been independently targeted at least 3 times in plants. The most common pattern which is being targeted by the plant immune system is this small region here within flagellin, which we call FLAG22. It's a 22 amino acid long epitope. And actually, FLAG22 is directly recognized by a leucinowitz repeat receptor kinase, which is called FLS2. And FLS2 is actually conserved in all plant species. So it seems that very early on in evolution, an ancestor of a modern plant have evolved to perceive this epitope. But more recently, it has been shown that other epitopes within the flagellin structure, FLAG2-28 and also CD2-1, were also recognized by the plant immune system, but in this case, in a species-dependent manner. Rice has evolved to recognize this epitope, and no other plant outside of the grasses is able to recognize this epitope. And here we have another case where the Solanaceae family, such as tomato or potato, are recognizing another epitope, which is called here. And again, this is specific to Solanaceae. And a similar dual recognition of flagellin has actually evolved as well in mammals. For example, toll-like receptor 5 is targeted as well, this region here of flagellin. And within the cell, a typical NLR protein, or at least a complex of them, which is here the 95 NRC4 complex, will recognize the C-terminal part of flagellin. At the moment, we don't know any example of an intracellular immune receptor for flagellin. There have been some reports that this may occur, but actually it was later shown that this was due to a contamination of flagellin in the extracellular space caused during type 3 secretion and taking flagellin, if you want, as a byproduct of the type 3 secretion system. So while the same molecule is being targeted independently, you can see that the epitopes differ between plant and mammals. And this is another illustration here of similarity and differences in the way different kingdoms have evolved to recognize similar molecules. This is in the case of lipopolysaccharides, which is a potent PAMPs both in mammals as well as in plants. And for many years, we didn't know the receptor for LPS. And last year, the group of Dirk Scheel in Halle has finally reported the first example of a plant receptor for LPS. It turned out to be a receptor kinase, but instead of having an LRR, for example, in its ectodomain, the ectodomain is constituted of a lectin type of binding domain. And here what you can see is that, again, while the same molecule is being targeted for immune recognition in these two kingdoms, the mechanism involved in the recognition are distinct. Here, a classical example of an LPS receptor in mammals is TLR4, and also more recently, there were examples of caspases within the cell of being a receptor for LPS. So this rather illustrates that while common strategies are being used for immune perception, this rather reflects convergent evolution. And it just made sense to target conserved molecules such as flagellin and LPS, but the actual mechanism involved in this perception are different. And I can make basically a similar point if we now to go to downstream signaling. And a lot of my colleagues will actually use this slide, often to convince funding agencies, but there are a lot of similarities. What I will argue is that, yes, there are similarities, but if you look at the actual proteins, there is no orthologous protein in these two pathways. The only thing which is similar is that similar biochemical modules have been recruited either for perception or for signaling. LRR is really good at perceiving a protein or a peptide. The kinase is very good at conveying signaling, and this is why they have been independently recruited for immune perception and immune signaling. So in my lab, we basically use the innate immune system of plant to study different processes, or we have different interests. We basically work on receptors, we work on signaling pathways, and we work on immunity. For receptors, as I mentioned, we are keen to identify novel plants recognized by plants, and what are the receptors which are involved in this perception. For signaling, which really represent our major activity, we are interested in understanding biochemically what is a molecular basis of innate immune signaling, concentrating on protein complexes at the plasma membrane and the post-translational events within these complexes, which underline the activation of immune signaling, but as well, as I will illustrate, also which underline how these receptor complexes are tightly regulated to avoid overactivation of immune responses. We are keen to then understand, once these receptor complexes are getting activated, how they activate and recruit downstream signaling components, and actually to identify what are these components. If you want, there's a big black box downstream of this immune receptor to understand how ultimately they will lead to disease resistance. But because our receptor are really well characterized receptor kinases, and we have the ligand that directly bind to these receptors, and also that we can add this ligand, a synthetic peptide, for example, in the case of flagellin, this is a beautiful system to study receptor kinase-mediated signaling. We can literally add on a peptide on this plant and turn on signaling, and we can follow within a few milliseconds what are the signaling events occurring. So we are generally understanding, we're generally interested in understanding the mode of action of receptor kinases, and they involve in all processes of plant life, from reproduction to development to growth. And more recently, we became interested to understand how these receptor kinases are getting integrated within the plasma membrane, and now they form specialized signaling platform within microdomain of the plasma membrane. And we think that this underlies partly signaling specificity in plants, and how to explain that so many different receptor kinases may be within plasma membrane, and yet the outcome of the activation of these receptor kinases can be as different as growth or immunity, for example. This brings us to our interest in signaling specificity, which is mostly to try to understand what is the interplay between immunity and growth, because a lot of the downstream components actually share between these pathways, but yet the outcome is different. And recently, also, we became interested to understand what is the role of endogenous peptides and the active secretion and processing of this peptide in regulating the immune system, and also other processes such as abiotic stress, for example, drought resistance. But finally, we study most of that in the context of immunity, and a big question in plant biology is still, at the end, what is causing disease resistance. We don't know what is restricting the pathogen growth in most cases. And how to use the knowledge of all of these different programs to actually try to engineer broad-spectrum disease-resistant in crop, which we hope will be more durable than the current strategies which have been used. So to study signaling, which is this part, we are using two receptors as model system. They are leucine-rich repeat receptor kinases. One of them is called FLS2, which is a receptor for bacterial flagellin, and the other is a related protein called EFR. But EFR will recognize another protein from bacteria, which is called EFTU, elongation factor TU. In both cases, we know the epitope, which is recognized. It is FLAG22 for flagellin, ALF18 for EFTU. We know that these receptors are important for antibacterial immunity of plants. If we have a loss of function mutant in both FLS2 and EFR, in this case in Arabidopsis thaliana, the plant is hypersusceptible to bacterial infection. And what we have shown, at least in the case of EFR, which seems to be an innovation of the Brassicaceae family, such as cabbage, for example, of mustard, when we transfer EFR into a plant species that normally does not contain this receptor, such as tomato, we can actually render tomato more resistant to an adapted bacterial pathogen. In this case, this is Rhizoctonia, which is causing bacterial wilt. So these receptors are both important for immunity, but they are also sufficient to confer immunity when introduced in a plant species that does not contain individual receptor. But mostly we use this receptor as a model to address this very simple question, who anyone who is working on a receptor is interested to address. It's basically, how do you convey ligand binding, in this case, in the extracellular space, into an intracellular signaling chain of event? And this may sound like a very simple question to address, especially in the case of a receptor kinase, because it is a beautiful protein that within one entity combines the ligand binding, its anchoring within the plasma membrane, and the kinase domain that will convey signaling. But what we have realized, as everything in biology, is that things are more complicated than expected. And the first layer of complexity is summarized in this slide, which basically summarizes 10 years of work for many different groups around the world. Now we know, thanks to work on immunity, that there is a general principle by which plant receptor kinases are working. There is a receptor defined biochemically by direct binding to the ligand. So in our case, this is FLS2 or EFR. And despite that being all the domain that it required to work, this receptor, the first thing it will do within a few milliseconds is actually to recruit a co-receptor. And this co-receptor is as well a receptor kinase, in this case, a leucinowich repeat receptor kinase. The most common one is called BAC1. It's part of a small mutagenic family, which in Arabidopsis has 5 members, which is called the CERC family. There are then transphosphorylation events between the receptor and the co-receptor within the kinase domain, and this will lead to the activation of a downstream substrate, which is again a kinase, but in this case, a cytosolic kinase. The most studied one is called BIC1. Everything in plant is part of large mutagenic family. This family has about 30 members. It is called the PBL family. There is a lot of genetic redundancy, which make genetic study of these processes rather tedious. And then this kinase will get phosphorylated itself, and the job of a kinase is to phosphorylate a substrate. And so a big question at the moment in the field is to identify what are the substrate of these cytoplasmic kinases, because they basically connect receptor activation to downstream immune signaling. So if I take you step by step through the kind of questions we are trying to understand, we are first interested to understand how the ligand is being bound by the receptor. And we have this long-time collaboration with this two excellent group in China, Diji Shai from Tsinghua University, who is a structural biologist, and Jiamin Zhao, with whom we collaborate very closely to study immune signaling, who is at the Chinese Academy of Science. And Gigi's lab managed to get a co-crystal between the ectodomain here of FLS2 and the ectodomain of BAC1 together with the ligand FLAG22. And the first thing that this enables is to actually define the binding site for FLAG22. And if you think of an ectodomain composed here of 28 LRR repeats, you could imagine that basically the peptide could only bind, in theory, to one LRR. But in reality, what this structure revealed is that the peptide is binding to 14 different LRR, which is shown here. But to us, the most interesting finding of this structure was the fact that the C-terminal part of the ligand here was actually directly binding not only with FLS2, the receptor, but directly as well with the co-receptor. And what this work and subsequent work showed is that basically the ligand is acting as a molecular glue, bringing the receptor and the co-receptor together, and then most likely within the cell, enabling the two kinase domain to become in close proximity to enable transphosphorylation event. And this model has now been shown to be true for many different plant receptor kinases. So once this complex, this stable complex is being formed, obviously the receptor complex has to get activated. We are actively working on this, trying to understand what is the role of phosphorylation in the activation of this receptor complex. These kinases are extremely weak biochemically, which make this work technically challenging. But in the meantime, we managed to identify a single tyrosine residue, which was critical for the activation of immune response. If we block this phosphorylation of a single residue, tyrosine residue, we completely block the function of the EFR receptor. But in addition, what we reveal here, and this is just to show how sophisticated pathogens are manipulating the host physiology, we could identify a type 3 secreted effector from Salmonella syringae called OPA1, which is a tyrosine phosphatase. And what OPA1 is doing is to directly interact with the kinase domain of immune receptors, such as at EFR, and blocking the tyrosine phosphorylation, thereby blocking the activation of immune responses and leading to an increased virulence on this host. At the moment, we are still trying to identify further residues which are phosphorylated either on the receptor or on the co-receptor. For EFR, we are keen to identify residue that not necessarily are critical for its function, but enable the branching of downstream signaling, because we know that immediately downstream of the immune receptor, there are a number of different cellular output we can measure, and this is directly specified at the level of the kinase. In the case of BAC1, this co-receptor, which I illustrated here, actually, BAC1 turned out to be a co-receptor virtually for all LRR-containing receptor kinases in plant. And there are over 200 in plant, and they are involved in growth, development, and immunity. And we had this hypothesis that Bach 1, and actually results supporting that, that Bach 1 is able to confer sealing specificity, and that some of that could be encoded within by phosphorylation. And we have indeed recently identified 5 residues within the kinase domain of Bach 1, which are phosphorylated only after perception of a PAMP, and that are only involved in immune signaling, but they are not required for the function of Bach 1 in growth or development. And so therefore, we have been able to define the phosphocode of signaling specificity mediated by Bach 1. So as I mentioned to you before, if you look at this very simplified model here, the common substrate of many downstream substrate of many different PRRs in plant is this cytoplasmic kinase called BIC1. So now the challenge is to identify what are the substrate of these kinases. And actually, a few years ago, we revealed the first example of a substrate for BIC1, and we could show that the receptor complex directly through BIC1 directly activate one of the enzymes which is required for one of the cellular outputs we can measure rapidly after PAMP perception. And this is the production of reactive oxygen species in an oxidative burst in the extracellular space of plants. And so this enzyme is an NADPH oxidase. In plant, it is called RBOH. In arabidopsis, it is called RBOHD. And we could show that BIC1 directly associate with RBOHD and directly phosphorylate RBOHD on 3 different residues, and that this phosphorylation is critical and requires, for the function of this enzyme, and most likely is priming the later regulation of this enzyme by calcium binding and phosphorylation by calcium-dependent protein kinases. So The two last points that we are trying to understand is how these complexes are negatively regulated. And this is something that a project basically told us it was important. Biology brought us back to this question. And in a way, it makes sense because it is very important for the plant to avoid overactivation of immune responses, but also to make sure that the timing of immune responses is appropriate. They are not triggered too early and also not too late in order to mount immunity. And as I mentioned before, we have a specific interest in signaling specificity, mostly between immunity and growth. So we'll just spend 1 or 2 minutes on the negative regulation. And actually, the importance of the negative regulation of innate immune responses is also now becoming more and more apparent in animals. And there's this beautiful review published beginning of the year, in Nature Reviews Immunology, which is actually discussing the importance of negative regulation as well as the activation of immune responses at the same time in this kind of yin-yang schematic. So here's just a summary of recent insight into the tight regulation of these immune receptor complexes in Arabidopsis. And maybe not surprisingly, given that all of these proteins are kinases and the important role of phosphorylation, a lot of the negative regulation is occurring is triggered by protein phosphatases. And basically, now we have identified protein phosphatases that target every single step of this complex. We have here 2 PP2Cs, one that targets the receptor itself, another one that targets BIC1, and we have here a holoenzyme of PP2A that keep the co-receptor under control in the absence of PAM perception. In addition, 2 years ago, we identified a calcium protein, calcium-dependent protein kinase called CPK28, which in this case is not regulating the activity of BIC1, but is regulating the turnover of BIC1. This enzyme is always active, and it was showing that this enzyme, this CPK, is here to buffer immune signaling by making sure we have the appropriate amount of BIC1. This work also revealed that BIC1 is rate limiting and the pathway, and we could indeed show since that we can simply modulate the amount of BIC1 within the cell, and this is sufficient to modulate the amplitude of immune response in response to PAM perception. And more recently, work from Jiamin Zhao, a collaborator in China, also revealed the role of small G proteins in the regulation of the turnover of BIC1. All of this regulation is dynamic and use different processes for that. And for example, in response to PAM perception, the PP2C here that negatively regulate BIC1 would get phosphorylated and would dissociate from the complex, and the PP2A would become less active, although we still don't fully understand the mechanism involved in this downregulation. So I just thought, without showing you real data, I would just summarize recent work on this early signaling event. And now, basically, I will switch gears and introduce you to our work on how trying to engineer crop to become more disease resistant. So as you may know, actually, a global challenge that face humanity and scientists and politicians is actually how we will feed the world, which is increasing in its population. It will about double, more than double in 30, 40 years, reaching to 9 billion. There is an issue to feed all of these people. Some of this issue may be more social, and I'm not here to discuss them, but there is also a responsibility for scientists to try to find solution to feed this ever-growing population. And a major limitation to agriculture, or at least to intensive agriculture, is actually posed by pathogens. I just want to illustrate this by using this extreme case. This is a soy field in Brazil. As you can see, it's a scale that is not near to be seen in Europe. To give you an idea of the scale, this is the harvest of the crop acting here. The trucks you see just behind are actually here to plant the next season. Under this climate, under this soil, you can literally collect, replant, and do several like this generation within one season. The only reason this can be achieved beyond water availability and the richness of the soil is by using a lot of chemical control to avoid disease development. And often this is performed using here this plane. This has to be done up to 8 years through growing season, or eight times, sorry, through any growing season. And a lot of these chemicals are getting either banned, this is already the case in the EU, or are becoming inactive because the pathogen are becoming resistant to these chemicals. The major pathogen here in Brazil is a single one. It's a fungus, and it's causing this disease called Asian soybean rust, and this is a Latin name which I will not try to pronounce. This is a multi-billion problem simply because of the cost of the chemicals that need to be applied to grow soybean in Brazil. This is not limited to this pathogen. In this review, which was published 4 years ago in Nature, the author have tried to, or they have actually listed some of the major crop pathogens. Many of them are fungi or oomycetes, at least under our climate. And they have tried to put a cost in terms of human lives on this different disease. And they have come with this number, maybe the later one is a bit exaggerated, but you can see that basically, if we were able to control these diseases, we could feed a lot more people on Earth, and it is equally important to solve cancer or other epidemic diseases than to try to achieve food security. And so actually in our field, the community that study plant immunity, we have now come to the realization that we understand enough of, conceptually at least, of the molecular basis of immunity, that it's time for us to capitalize on this recent finding to try to find solutions to address food security and plant diseases. And this was just summarized, this thought, in this review here published in Science a few years ago. So actually, about when I started my lab, 10 years ago now almost, we already thought that we can use our work on PRRs to try to achieve this. And we had this idea that maybe we could use PRRs to engineer broad-spectrum disease resistance in crops. And this was based on the realization of what I told you before, that actually some PAMs actually only recognized by plants in a species or family-specific manner. Flagellin will be recognized by all plant species. It is not useful to develop FLAG22 perception in crops. But for example, EFTU, as I mentioned, is only recognized by one family of plants, which is in this case the Brassicaceae. But actually, EFTU is conserved in virtually all bacteria. So we, as a proof of concept study, what we did, we took EFR, in this case from Arabidopsis thaliana, which is a Brassicaceae, and we express it in another type of plant species, which is here the Solanaceae plant. This is Nicotiana bentamiana, a relative of tobacco and tomato. We didn't know if it would work. The first thing that we realized that the receptor is accumulating. We then realized it is functional. It can perceive its ligand. It then inducing immune responses. And then, to our surprise, it actually even worked to confer disease resistance. This is illustrated here with one pathogen. You can, without looking at the graph, you can see that this plant is very sick and this one is healthier. This type of resistance was not specific to this strain. We could use another strain of Pseudomonas syringae, and we observed the same phenomenon. We can even use another genus of bacteria, in this case, Agrobacterium tumefaciens, that normally develop these tumors on plant, and the plant expressing EFR much more resistance. We observed the same in tomato, again, using a different genus of bacteria, Xanthomonas perforans. We saw increased resistance in the plant that express EFR. And the most striking effect, which I already showed before, was when we use this soil-borne pathogen, Rastonia, and here the plant is almost completely immune to this pathogen. So this was a proof of concept study, which basically illustrated that we can use PRR and transfer them, that they remain functional, and this could be used to engineer disease resistance in plant. But also more fundamentally, it illustrated that the downstream signaling component might be conserved between plant species, because we can literally take a receptor from one plant species, plug it into another plant species, and it will connect biochemically with downstream immune signaling. So we have now expanded this program mostly through collaboration around the world, public collaboration, a lot of them with institute and organization funded by the UN. And we have now transferred EFR in different Solanaceae plants and have a very promising result with a number of pathogens, more recently into apple as well and in citrus. We still have the question whether we could move receptors between different classes, botanical classes of plant, and crossing the barrier between what is called dicots and monocots. So indeed we can, and what we showed is that we can take EFR from Brassicaceae, express it here either in rice or in wheat, and it remained functional, it's conferring resistance. And we also did the reverse. We took an immune receptor from monocot, express it into a dicot, and could show that it remained functional and conferred disease resistance against bacteria. Some of these projects are quite advanced, mostly on potato and tomato, and through collaboration in both North Africa and South Africa, North America and South America, we have now data from field trials, and we are very pleased that this resistance is holding true in field condition. This is illustrated here, for example. This is a wild-type tomato plant. This is tomato plant that expresses EFR. The only difference is this immune receptor. And you can see that these plants are dying when infected by Rastonia, while this plant remains alive. And this leads under infecting condition to a doubling in the yield of tomato. More recently as well, this is a collaboration with Yasma in Italy. We could also express EFR in apple, and a major problem of apples, particularly now under our climate, is caused by Erwinia milavera, which is causing fire blight. It's a quarantine pathogen, and you can see that the plant remained fully healthy when we express EFR, while they completely die when the infection was performed here in the wild-type plant. So while we pioneer this approach, now a lot of people have actually showed the efficiency of such transfer, and this is just a summary of recent papers where indeed such immune receptor could be identified and transferred across plant species or plant families and shown to confer disease resistance. There is no silver bullet, and I just want to put a few words of caution, or maybe use that as an outlook. We are keen to use this knowledge to generate artificial PRRs, and this is in a kind of synthetic biology approach where we would like to be able to predict what is needed to recognize particular ligand, or potentially we could, rather than relying on transgenic, use genome editing to edit existing receptor and force them to recognize more efficiently, for example, a microbial inoculant that would be provided. There is a need for the community to identify more PRRs, especially the ones which are family specific. We need to develop toolboxes or bioassays, if you want, to study these responses. And we want them to be cheap and high throughput so that anyone in any field in the world can basically directly assess a breeding population, for example, in the field, and to select the line which has the most amenable to response to microbial perception in this case. And what would be very stupid from us and from industry would be to deploy this receptor one by one, because history told us already that the pathogen will always win and very rapidly will evolve to evade this recognition. So there is this idea in the field that potentially one way to evolve this or to increase the chance of durability is to pyramid different type of immune receptor, combining both PRRs, this surface receptor, with this intracellular receptor, this NLR, and this may increase the chance of durability. We are currently trying that in the US, where we are combining in tomato two PRRs, one from Arabidopsis, one from rice, and a typical NLR from pepper. And we are looking whether it will increase the durability for resistance against Xanthomonas. There is at the moment as well the great biotechnology opportunity to use genome editing to actually, in addition to engineer immune receptor, to potentially boost the on-plant immune system. But for example, targeting susceptibility genes, which are required for infection, which has a protein which are manipulated by the pathogen to make the host a favorable place, or actually to edit negative regulator to increase immune responses. But at the end, the pathogen will always win. And here's just a question how long it will take and to increase this time before the pathogen will overcome this. So we actively involved in a number of these projects, and this is my last slide. And while people have still rely, and this is working really well, on reverse genetics or forward genetics to identify novel immune receptors, this is limited to plant species where the post-genomic tools exist. And this is not necessarily the case for most crops. So more recently, we have been developing biochemical approaches to identify new receptors, either using ligand fishing, so if you will know the ligand, to basically go and fish out for the receptor, identify it through mass spectrometry, or to use our knowledge on the co-receptors to actually look for the receptor which rapidly, in a ligand-specific manner, will form a stable complex with the receptor. And more recently, we have also been developing high-throughput screening using cell-based assay to actually not only identify novel elicitors, but also rapidly screen immune receptors from a number of different plant species. And this is based on the increasing number of plant genomes which are becoming available. And with that, I just want to thank all of my lab. This was rather a summary presentation, so I will thank all of them, present and past member. All of my past members have stayed in science and have now a job of faculty or continuing in science. And we rely actively on the proteomic and bioinformatic groups, a number of collaborators, and obviously very generous funding from a lot of public organizations. Thank you very much.